Today is Wednesday, June 10th, 2026, and you're listening to the World Socialist website. A tribute to Gordon S. Wood, from 1933 to 2026. Historian of the American Revolution, by Tom Ackerman and David North. A tragic accident has brought to an end the life and career of one of the United States' major historians. Gordon S. Wood died Sunday at the age of 92, hours after being struck by a car while walking through a grocery store parking lot in East Providence, Rhode Island. He died later that day at Rhode Island Hospital, less than 1 month before the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, the commemoration of the revolution whose history he had spent a lifetime studying. It speaks to the degradation of democratic consciousness, intellectual life, and culture in the United States that Wood's death, apart from scattered and superficial obituaries placed on inside pages of newspapers, has gone largely unnoticed. The country's foremost historian of its own founding has passed from the scene. On the very eve of the semi-quicentennial, with hardly a ripple in official public life. Within the historical profession, however, Wood's death is deeply felt as a tragic loss. Several of his colleagues, reached by the World Socialist website, conveyed their admiration and grief. Carol Birkin, professor emerita at Barak College and the CUNY Graduate Center, wrote that Wood's work, quote, was the starting point even for those of us who focused on the economic or social origins of the struggle for independence, end quote. James Oakes, also of CUNY, noted that, quote, Wood was committed to the proposition that the War of Independence was also a radical revolution, an event that left an inspiring legacy we should all cherish. Richard D. Brown, professor emeritus at the University of Connecticut, remembered him as a, quote, great scholar, an honest, unpretentious person, and a true friend. His brilliance was manifest. Mary Beth Norton, professor emerita at Cornell University, and Peter S. Onuf, professor emeritus at the University of Virginia, sent similar messages of mourning. Timothy Hall Breen of Northwestern University, an author of The Will of the People, wrote, blending remarkably accessible prose and thorough research, Gordon Wood interpreted the American Revolution for an entire generation. He managed to bridge a divide between the academic historians and general readers, giving us a powerful story of political leaders who were not demigods but rather were men, who blended creativity and pragmatism to bring forth a new constitutional republic. End quote. The unpretentiousness recalled by Richard Brown was not a pose but a settled trait, one perhaps owing something to his working-class origins. In conversation, Wood wore his immense learning lightly, yet the range of that learning could astonish. He seemed to carry the entire world of 18th-century America in his head, moving without effort from the constitutional debates of 1787 to the etiquette of patronage and politeness in colonial society, from the marginalia of Adams and the correspondence of Jefferson to the land speculation of Aaron Burr, paper money schemes and tavern politics of the backcountry. Wood had read, it seemed, everything. The pamphlets, the newspapers, the sermons, the diaries, the account books, and retained it all, not as inert antiquarian detail, but as the living texture of a vanished world that he could summon at will, and he never ceased to find fascinating. In a career spanning 6 decades and numerous books, articles, and lectures, Wood established himself as the foremost historian of the American Revolution and the early Republic. His creation of the American Republic, 1776 to 1787, published in 1968, won the Bancroft Prize, and his The Radicalism of the American Revolution arguably the most important book yet written on the period of the American founding, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1993. Wood's Empire of Liberty, A History of the Early Republic, 1789 to 1815, published in 2009, was a landmark contribution to the Oxford History of the United States series initiated by C. Van Woodward and Richard Hofstadter. For nearly four decades, from 1969 until his retirement in 2008, Wood was a member of the faculty at Brown University, where he held the title of Alva O. Way University Professor. Wood was born on November 27, 1933, in Concord, Massachusetts, where the very first battle of the American Revolution had been fought, and where the youths of Emerson, Thoreau, and Louisa May Alcott had been nurtured a century earlier. He grew up in a working-class family in nearby Wooster and Waltman. Wood's father was a factory worker, and his mother took office work. Neither parent attended college. Wood later recalled finding high school history unbearable, suffering through classes in which the teacher simply read from a textbook. A Latin instructor encouraged him to attend nearby Tufts University, which he attended on ROTC funding, while commuting from home. He graduated summa cum laude in 1955. His subsequent Air Force service in Japan caused Wood to abandon earlier ambitions for a career in foreign service. He instead enrolled as a graduate student at Harvard University. There, Wood studied under the brilliant scholar of the colonial era, Bernard Bailyn, who was himself early on in a remarkable career. Precisely in those years, Bailyn was at work on a close study of the massive body of pamphlets that had, he surmised, created the political climate of the American Revolution, a study that resulted in his most important book, The Ideological Origins of the American Revolution, published in 1967. It won both the Bancroft and Pulitzer Prize, and remains worthy of careful reading today. Wood's own Creation of the American Republic, produced out of the dissertation he had completed under Bailyn, came just one year later. It announced the start of an extraordinary career that clearly owed much to the work of his mentor, but that went, in key respects, beyond it. The Bailyn School, which nurtured the careers of a constellation of significant historians, among them Pauline Meyer, Mary Beth Norton, Michael Kamen, Jack Rockoff, and Fred Anderson, produced three Pulitzer Prize winners in addition to Wood. Wood's writing, unlike much of academic history, was accessible to general readership. He achieved this without sacrificing complexity, and while still conveying his encyclopedic grasp of the archive. Like Bailyn, Wood possessed a rare literary gift, one rooted in a sensibility to those voices that survive in the historical record and in a respect for his readership. Much like the present, the past was a living world inhabited by actors confronting circumstances whose resolutions they themselves could not foresee. In Wood's hands, the revolutionary era ceased to be a familiar sequence of settled events, moving toward an outcome predetermined by the historians, and became instead a drama unfolding in real time, animated by uncertainty, conflict, possibility, and tragedy. Quote, "The past cannot see the future," Wood liked to remind students and colleagues. From this conviction followed Wood's emphatic rejection of historical anachronism, the ripping of historical figures out of their own time, in order to impose upon them the assumptions and standards of the contemporary world. Such an approach, Wood insisted, was inherently moralistic and hypocritical. It flattered the present at the expense of the past, converting history into an exercise in self-congratulation, and it rendered genuine historical understanding impossible. The men and women of the 18th century could not be indicted for failing to think and act as people of the 21st. The historian's task was to comprehend them with the world they actually inhabited, with its given limits and possibilities. Critics occasionally associate Bailyn and his students with the consensus school of American history, which, under the pressure of anti-communism of the post-World War II era, washed away conflict from American history in favor of a mythological American exceptionalism. This view of Balin and Wood's work is an error, sometimes also referred to as the Whig interpretation of history, a concept borrowed from British history writing. The consensus school, as it applied to the colonial revolutionary eras, is more accurately associated with Balin's contemporary at Yale University, Edmund S. Morgan. In fact, both Balin's ideological origins and Wood's creation of the American Republic revealed a world of intense conflict. Particularly with Balin, the focus of these contests was on ideology. It was a school that approached the record of human thought with great seriousness. In Wood's work, the social element was stronger than in Balin's. The revolutionary era was not merely one of competing ideas. Behind the politics were competing interests that ultimately found expression in the creation of entirely new concepts of political power that took the form of constitution writing. Wood crystallized this early work in a concise recent book, Power and Liberty, Constitutionalism in the American Revolution, published in 2021. Wood never went to great lengths to identify precisely what those interests were or how they related to social classes in the emerging capitalist world, a limitation dictated in great measure by his fidelity to the archive and his sensitivity to the nature of the society itself. There was no modern bourgeoisie or significant wage labor working class in the late colonial period, though both were emerging by the early Republican era. Instead, Wood insisted and demonstrated richly in The Radicalism of the American Revolution that what was at stake was the erosion and eventual collapse of a monarchical society. Monarchy and its social and property forms were weak in America, Wood acknowledged, but nonetheless they existed. The American Revolution was waged against this ancient regime, no less than the French Revolution was a decade later, a comparison from which Wood never shrank. It was an old world challenge and undone by what Jefferson called a new natural aristocracy of Republican leaders. But in tragic irony, these founders' vision of a republic governed by disinterested statesmen gave way, in Wood's telling, to a bustling, vulgar democracy commanded by career politicians representing a new, middling type. Wood was at his literary height when he conveyed the sense of tragedy over the outcome of the revolution felt by founding fathers who lived into the 1820s, figures such as Jefferson, Adams, and Madison. One senses that, to a certain extent, the authors shared their view, which he captured memorably at the conclusion of his Empire of Liberty. Quote, "No American had spoken more eloquently or more fully of the radical impulse of the Enlightenment than Jefferson. No one had expressed the radical meaning of the revolution, the deposition of tyrannical kings and the rising up of common people to an unprecedented degree of equality than Jefferson. Yet he always sensed that his Empire of Liberty had a cancer at its core that was eating away at the message of liberty and equality and threatening the very existence of the nation and its democratic self-government." Although Jefferson, in his final years, tried to retain his sunny hopes for the future, he had twinges of an impending disaster, whose sources he never fully understood. He and his colleagues had created a union devoted to liberty that contained an inner flaw that would nearly prove to be its undoing. The Virginians, who had done so much to bring about the United States, knew in their souls, as Madison intimated in his advice to the country from beyond the grave, that there was a serpent creeping with its deadly wiles in their Arcadian paradise. Like Madison, many of the older generation came to realize that slavery and farming, quote, "slavery and farming are incompatible," end quote. The Civil War was the climax of a tragedy that was preordained from the time of the Revolution. Only with the elimination of slavery could this nation that Jefferson had called the world's best hope for democracy even begin to fulfill its great promise. End of Wood's quote. These and other passages give the lie to some critics' claims that Wood was indifferent to the issue of slavery or to other forms of oppression. But while the historian did not shrink from the tragedy of unintended consequences, which, as Trotsky observed, always, quote, lay inherent in the contradiction between the awakened world of the mind and the stagnant limitation of means, end quote, Wood emphatically insisted on the revolutionary, transformative character of the American Revolution on its world historical significance. He never budged from this stance. This put Wood increasingly at odds with what passed for the academic left, which came to find in the American Revolution either a scheme to perpetuate elite white male rule, the argument advanced by identity-centered historians, or else a non-event, as maintained by scholars influenced by postmodernism. It was indeed in response to such arguments that Wood wrote The Radicalism of the American Revolution. The book has never been forthrightly answered by his critics. When the World Socialist website first interviewed Wood in 2014, he expressed confidence that postmodernist approaches to history would never gain broad traction among the public. Yet academia eventually served as the basis for a far-reaching assault on the historical significance of the American Revolution. The campaign would emerge from none other than the flagship publication of American liberalism, The New York Times, which earlier back in 1969 had praised Wood's The Creation of the American Republic as, quote, one of the half dozen most important books ever written about the American Revolution, end quote. Wood was already elderly when the Times launched this attack on the subject of his life's work, but he responded with the vigor of a much younger man. It was the World Socialist website that initiated the fight against the 1619 Project. In the autumn of 2019, the WSWS published a series of interviews with historians Victoria Bynum, James Oakes, and James McPherson, exposing the project's major errors of concept and fact. In November 2019, Wood sat down with the WSWS for an extended interview of his own. Together, these interviews were read hundreds of thousands of times. Wood later joined several of these historians in an open letter to the Times, which pressed the criticism that had first been raised in the WSWS interviews and demanded corrections. The Times was forced on the defensive. Its defenders in the academic pseudo-left launched vicious attacks on Wood and McPherson, paced by Nicole Hannah-Jones, who condemned these eminent scholars as white historians who could never understand American history on account of their race. Hannah-Jones elaborated a quasi-zoological view in which not only did one's race determine one's view of history, but in which history itself was the never-ending working out of the conflict between, quote, white Americans and blacks. It remains a travesty and a shame that so few in the profession found the nerve to oppose these foul and intellectually bankrupt attacks. Against them, Wood preserved with remarkable energy. He carried on his collaboration with the World Socialist website, joining an important webinar on American Independence Day 2020, the place of the two American revolutions, past, present, and future. Many thousands viewed this event, which also includes Oakes, Bynum, Claiborne, Carson of Stanford University, and Richard Carwardine of Oxford, as well as labor historians and WSWS writer Tom Mackeman and David North, the editorial board chairman of the WSWS. Wood was not a socialist or a Marxist, and neither he nor the WSWS made any claim to the contrary. What fused our work was a common insistence that the American Revolution was a transformative event, that it was indeed a revolution, as well as our common insistence on a truthful, objective approach to history. Wood appreciated this collaboration. In 2021, he wrote to his WSWS interviewer, "You seem to be the only historian who understands what I was saying in my radicalism book." The correspondence continued until just a few weeks before his death. Wood said that he had finally retired from writing. "At 92, it would be foolhardy to continue," he wrote. but he was looking forward to a full schedule of events marking the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution. At the close of his life, as the United States approached the 250th anniversary of independence amid deep political and social crisis, Wood stood as one of the last major representatives of a historical tradition that is now embattled and endangered. He belonged to a generation of historians who believed that the past could be understood objectively, that ideas mattered, and that great revolutions altered the course of human history. He rejected cynicism, superficial and ahistorical present-mindedness, and the reduction of history to race, identity, or power for its own sake. For him, the American Revolution remained one of the decisive events in the democratic development of humanity, however incomplete and contradictory its results. That conviction animated his scholarship across more than half a century and gave his work its enduring vitality. It will be read long after the racialist falsifications and postmodernist evasions that he combated in his last years of life have been discredited, not only in scholarly works, but also, and most importantly, by the practice of a radicalized working class that draws encouragement and inspiration from the ideals of the first American Revolution. Workers at Flint Assembly and Next Tier should stop production. Anger mounts against UAW collusion with American Axle strike breaking, by Sheila Brehm and Jerry White. Are you an American Axle, Next Tier, or Big Three auto worker? Fill out the form at the end of this article to get information on building rank and file committees. United Auto Workers officials at the General Motors Flint Assembly Plant are allowing GM to truck in axles from the strike-bound American Axle plant, Dow Corp, in Three Rivers, Michigan, according to information contained in a Detroit Free Press article Monday. This has provoked anger from rank-and-file workers at the GM plant, who want to actively support their brothers and sisters on the picket lines just 130 miles from Flint. 1,000 UAW members, who top out at $22 an hour after a 5-year progression, struck May 31st to recoup decades of UAW-backed concessions. Quote, General Motors Flint Assembly Plant receives about 7 truckloads of axles every day to produce the automaker's most profitable vehicles, pickups. The Free Press notes, adding, if these axles stop coming from Three Rivers, GM would be forced to shut down the line at Flint. End quote. Right now, however, deliveries are continuing, and the assembly plant is running at full tilt, with one Flint GM worker telling the World Socialist website, we've been running nonstop 6 days a week, building 380-plus trucks a shift to build up inventory. End quote. Citing UAW Local 598 shop chairman Eric Welter, the Free Press wrote, the Wall Street Journal reported that GM has about 2 weeks' worth of axles stockpiled, which Welter said makes sense because the semis continue to arrive full and on time. It quotes Welter as saying, we bring in trucks all day long, every couple of hours to supply the line. End quote. This does not cause the slightest consternation for Welter, UAW President Sean Fain, or the rest of the Solidarity House apparatus, whose central concern is not the fate of American Axle workers, but the potential impact of their strike on GM's bottom line. It's a big monster of money, Welter told the newspaper. There's a lot on the line for GM with this strike. In comments to the Free Press, Welter feigns sympathy for the Three Rivers workers. The newspaper writes, these workers have been underpaid a very long time, Welter said. This is their opportunity and they're taking advantage of it. It's pretty rough to think they work at those wages with the way the economy is. It's unfortunate it had to go this way. End quote. This is sheer hypocrisy. The UAW bureaucracy is enforcing GM's diktats and forcing Flint workers to build GM Silverado and Sierra pickup trucks with axles from American Axle. The trucks also use steering components manufactured at the Next Tier Automotive plant 36 miles away in Saginaw, Michigan, where rank-and-file workers have rejected 3 UAW-backed sellout contracts and are demanding to strike alongside American Axle workers. The next tier workers voted by 86% to authorize a strike, but the local 699 and the UAW international bureaucracy have extended the previous contract behind the backs of the workers and are now pushing for a fourth sellout tentative agreement. On the GM Flint shop floor, there is widespread sentiment for solidarity action to support the workers in the Three Rivers and Saginaw. One worker told the World Socialist website, quote, "Workers at Flint Assembly and Next Tier should stop production and join the strike of American Axle workers. United, we're in a more powerful position." End quote. On the local 598 active members Facebook page, another worker posted, "I was down there yesterday, and they do have management and scabs working. They made 100 axles in one day. The night before the strike, they had about 20 trucks pulling everything in stock out. They have security all over the picket line, 6 gates, about 6 to each gate, standing there watching and recording them. Several workers living in vans in the parking lots because they can't afford a house, with a cheap apartment, $2,000 a month. Everyone was grateful for our time and donations." End quote. Welter dismissed workers' anger over handling parts from the strike-bound plant and cynically told workers to enjoy the overtime pay rates for as long as they could. The following exchanges appeared on the local 598 members' communication app over the past few days. Question: is the UAW going to make sure we're only using union-made axles if they, American Axle, really have a non-union skeleton crew running? Answer: the IUAW is monitoring inventory. Question: I see a lot of GM plants canceled Saturdays. Why are we still working if we have a limited supply of axles? Answer: the UAW is in a labor dispute with American Axle, which is negatively impacting GM. We are just going to have to wait and see and enjoy the overtime rate. We may be needing the money soon enough. A young part-time temporary worker, PTT, posted a message titled, "Strike for more and work for all the PTT workers." Quote, "Flint Assembly should go on strike for more pay and more work for all the part-time workers. We get treated like crap, and we can barely make it in this society with the little pay we get and hours. This is the best time now to do it. It would also help the full-time seniority people out as well." Welter replied, "We cannot strike in the middle of an agreement." End quote. This is not the first time a UAW officials have colluded in a strike-breaking operation. During the 2023 Clarios battery strike near Toledo, Ohio, rank-and-file members challenged Welter over the continued use of batteries from the struck plant. Welter responded that the batteries were pre-strike inventory and then invoked federal labor law. The National Labor Relations Act is clear under hot cargo that we have to continue to unload, and this is the direction from the International Union. End quote. During the UAW's 2022 Constitutional Convention, a largely symbolic resolution to prohibit the handling of parts from struck facilities was defeated, with bureaucrats claiming such a ban would, quote, "tie the hands" of the union in negotiations. The cowardice and complicity of the UAW bureaucracy should be contrasted with the heroic stand of workers at GM Silao Mexico Assembly Plant, who refused to work overtime producing Silverado and Sierra pickups during the 2019 GM strike in the U.S. They took this real solidarity action despite retaliation from GM, the gangster-ridden CTM Mexican Union bureaucracy, and Mexican authorities. Welter cries crocodile tears over the low pay American Axle workers receive, but the UAW bureaucracy is directly responsible for their destitution. As part of its long-standing labor-management partnership, the UAW apparatus deliberately widened the wage gap between parts and assembly workers to boost the competitiveness of the Big Three, a policy that ultimately rebounded on assembly workers themselves. This included the sellout of the 1998 strike at GM's Flint Metal Center and Delphi East plants, which was immediately followed by the spin-off of the company's Delphi's division, from which Next Tier emerged. In 2005, Delphi declared bankruptcy and imposed 60% wage cuts with the UAW's complicity. In 2008, the UAW shut down an 87-day American Axle strike and agreed to slash wages from $29 to $14.50 an hour. Two-tier structures, first imposed at the Big Three in 2007 and hardened in the 2009 Obama-backed restructuring of GM and Chrysler, followed directly afterwards. If the bureaucracy has its way, it will confine the American Axle strike to a single plant, end it before it has any impact on GM, and use workers as extras for photo ops with Democratic Party politicians running for Michigan governor and for the U.S. Senate. Fain will then present whatever rotten deal he gets as a victory at the UAW's 39th Constitutional Convention, which opens June 15th in Detroit. But these plans have been disrupted by a growing revolt of parts workers against decades of UAW betrayals. In addition to the rebellion by the next-tier workers in Saginaw, workers at Bridgewater Interiors in Warren, Michigan, rejected a UAW-backed sellout. Yet, local 400 officials have not even called a strike authorization vote. Earlier this week, Dana workers in Fort Wayne, Indiana, overwhelmingly rejected a deal recommended by the UAW, which Independence Parts Suppliers, or IPS, director Richard Boyer said included, quote, healthy wage increases. In fact, starting pay is $20 an hour, and new workers will top out at $25 an hour after 4 years. Workers with over 5 years of seniority will only reach $28 in June 2029, and there's no cost of living adjustment anywhere in the agreement. The Next Tier Workers Rank and File Committee has issued an open letter to American Axle strikers calling for united action. The open letter states, quote, a common strike across parts suppliers would bring the whole industry to its knees. Just-in-time delivery means assembly lines run dry within days. End quote. The letter outlines concrete measures, refusal to handle parts from struck facilities, united action by assembly and parts workers, parity pay between Big Three and supplier workers, the abolition of tiers, progressions, and all other divisions the UAW bureaucracy has used to lower wages and weaken solidarity. The way forward is through the expansion of rank-and-file committees, independent of the union apparatus. Flint truck workers, American Axle workers, Next Tier workers, Dana workers, and workers throughout the auto industry must establish direct lines of communication, share information, and prepare coordinated action based on workers' needs, not what management or the UAW bureaucracy deems acceptable. You can find all this and more at the World Socialist website, WSWS.org. This has been Archie Stone for the World Socialist website.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.